History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And really, they don't have to go untold. If we'll just take the initiative to ask a few questions of some of our more experienced neighbors, and more importantly, to patiently listen to what they have to say, it's amazing how much we can learn. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price it's been paid for our freedom. And not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. There's a lot going on this time of year. Valentine's Day, it's also Black History Month, but the middle of February each year also brings the Day of Remembrance, something that is very important to Americans of Japanese ancestry, and as I hope we all understand by the time this hour is over, really should be important to the rest of us as well. February 19th marks the 79th anniversary of Executive Order 9066. Which led to the incarceration of 120,000 people forced out of their West Coast homes and locked up behind barbed wire simply because of their heritage. At the time, even those who wanted to enlist in our armed forces were denied that opportunity and declared enemy aliens. I don't know about you, but when I listen to veterans share their stories here on Hometown Heroes, I often try to imagine how I might handle some of the situations they were faced with. And while every story is unique, I have to say that some categories stand out. It's always sobering to hear from a veteran who's been severely wounded, or one that has become a prisoner of war and doesn't know when or if he'll ever taste freedom again. There's another group that always really gets to me. Anytime I have the privilege of visiting with a veteran who chose to risk his life for the very country that was holding his family captive, it really makes me wonder if I would have been able to make that same choice. You've heard dozens of Nisei veterans on this program over the years, but today we're going to hear about a new book that captures that chapter of our history from a few different lenses. The book is Tears of Honor, a novel of Japanese-American heroism in World War II. The author is James Ardize, formerly a prosecutor, judge, and presiding justice of the California 5th District Court of Appeals. That background in the legal realm gives him perspective on the infamous 1944 case Korematsu versus United States, in which the Supreme Court upheld Executive Order 9066 as constitutional. Since then, of course, that's been repudiated, but Ardize also captures how this time in history impacted people and families. And he introduces us to some heroes you may never have heard about. Again, the book is Tears of Honor. I have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. It's the culmination of years of painstaking research and interviews by James Ardize, who joins us now. Can you tell us why this project was so important to you and what it was that really compelled you to write Tears of Honor?
Well, it started out with me giving a speech about the Korematsu decision and the failure of the American judiciary when they were confronted with these detention orders. And as I began to explore that, I became more and more interested in the background and then the story, and then it expanded. Why did the government do this? The human interest aspect of the people that were relocated and detained, and why did they go as peacefully and as passively as they did? What was the motivation of the men that went and fought in Europe and left the camps? And my curiosity about why would somebody go and fight for their country the way that they did when the country had rejected their parents and left their parents in detention centers? And those were real detention centers, I mean, with armed guards and wire and guard towers with machine guns. So I just started reading more and more about it, and I thought, nobody really knows this story from all different perspectives, and how would you present that? That evolved into the idea of writing this book and telling aspects of this story that I thought were really important.
And that's what strikes me about what you've done here, is that there are books that capture a first-person account. maybe even multiple first-person accounts. And that's what we hear on this show, are first-person accounts, people who live some of this. But to bring all the different perspectives that you bring together in this expansive view of it, from what I've read over the years, I mean, this is unprecedented. I'm curious for you. I mean, both of your parents were in World War II. I'm sure you grew up with some kind of awareness of what had happened in the internment, and you read about Korematsu in law school. But I have the sense that in the last 5 years working on this book, that you've learned a lot yourself that you're now passing on to us.
Well, that's really true. You know, I have long had an interest in history, and I was aware of the 442nd. I really wasn't that much aware of the 100th because they generated out of Hawaii. I was aware of Manzanar. I wasn't aware of Jerome and Rohr and Poston, the internment camps that existed. I was kind of aware of our Fresno fairgrounds being used, but I really didn't give it a lot of thought. I mean, like most kids growing up in the valley, I went to the fair, I saw the stables and the rest of that, but I didn't relate it to any of that. I didn't really know the story of how people in the Central Valley reacted to this, and I wanted to, as I read about it, I wanted to tell the story that people here recognize the distinctions between ethnic groups. Didn't really make any difference. I mean, the valley is a real stew, an ethnic stew. You have Italians and you have Armenians and you have Irish and you have Germans and Portuguese and Mexicans and everything else. They've always maintained a certain amount of ethnic distinction, although that's kind of dissipated over the years. But at back in these times, World War II, the separation among the ethnic groups was much more distinct. And yet at the same time, they all viewed themselves as Americans. And of course, obviously, there was prejudice. There were all kinds of things. But when push came to shove and we got down to this, the valley really reflected an attitude of, well, these are our neighbors. You know, they may not look the same. They may not talk exactly the same. But these are our neighbors. And I was very impressed with the fact of how many people actually took their neighbor's farms and farmed for them. And when their neighbor returned, they gave the keys back and they gave the money back and everybody went on and nobody talked about that. Yeah, there were distinctions, but in the end they were all neighbors and that's how they behaved. And I thought, you know, that's an important point, that they viewed themselves maybe not so much even as Americans, but as neighbors. Many of them were personally opposed to what happened to the Japanese Americans, but they weren't vocal like they are now. You know, now everybody goes out and marches around, they have a placard, and people didn't do that. I couldn't even imagine if we singled out an ethnic group nowadays and said, I want you to report to the Fresno fairgrounds, that they would do it the way it was done here. So all of these things I thought were interesting stories that give us a perspective on our forebears. And then there's just such heroism and patriotism involved here. I mean, it's a real American story.
Well, and you said something there, you know, if something like this happened today, how would people react? And whether that be an ethnic group or an age group or an ideological group, if something like this was attempted again, how different would it be? And I get the sense that that's part of the motivation for writing this book, to hope that there's a way to ensure this never happens again. Kind of like the way we talk about the Holocaust, right? It's important to keep that history alive so it doesn't happen again. Is that part of your motivation for this? And are there some ways you tried to express that in there that you're really satisfied with how that came out to get that kind of point across?
The answer to that is yes. The one thing that I wanted to make clear in this book, and I really, it's very difficult to make it clear in a book of this nature because you're addressing so many different things, is how easily it happened. I mean, you look at the recourse that we would normally have, which is the court system, and you have all of this hysteria that exists in the United States at that time with the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, and the fact that you have an ethnic or racial group that is distinctive in appearance, and it doesn't take very much for things like this to happen. You have a failure of the government leadership, demagoguing an issue, for example, for political purposes, which whips people up in the frenzy. And then you have the judiciary, which is our point where they're supposed to resist this. They're not supposed to lead the mob. They're supposed to stand in front. Mm-hmm. And you have the failure of the American judiciary, which is what happened in Korematsu. And then you have the system begin to fall apart because it adapts to something that shouldn't have been adapted to. And so you see how easily civil rights and particular groups can just simply be segregated from society and their conduct justified. And it really doesn't make any difference whether it's based on ethnicity or race or ideology. When there's a real failure to recall or remember that this can happen to you, and you allow it to happen, you understand the consequences, how easily we can lose our liberty, how easily we can lose our freedom, how easily we forget that we have a common bond, which is the Constitution. It's not ethnic, it's the Constitution. We have kind of an American spirit, but the reality is it's the Constitution. And when we forget about that, we end up with things like what happened here. But I was amazed at how easily it happened. And yeah, I can see the same things occurring again whenever our institutions that are our stopgaps begin to fail.
And they didn't even have social media then. Can you imagine how much gas that would have poured on the fire?
I always say all progress is not good.
On that note, and I want to talk to you about some of the other things you learned. I mean, you learned about a real hero that you tell the story of in this book, and I think that's going to be something a lot of people are thankful for when they read this book, is learning about a certain character in there. There are a lot of characters, real-life characters, that I've heard about from time to time, some who I've met in the past, but there's a real hero in here. You tell his story, and I want to get to that. But big picture-wise, again, I mean, you're a legal scholar. You've been in that world for so long. You knew about the Korematsu case. But in the research you've done, was there something that you've come across from the big picture and the timeline that became almost alarming to you or really eye-opening?
Well, yeah. I mean, when you go to law school, you read about famous American judges. You study their decisions. There are certain icons that exist. Earl Warren, William O. Douglas, Felix Frankfurter, Black, people like Justice Jackson and Murphy, and you read about their decisions. You know, we think of them as liberals and conservatives. I realized in my research that Earl Warren, for example, who became governor of California and Chief Justice of the United States and is generally regarded as the principal architect of Brown versus Board of Education and major civil rights legislation. As I began to read about what he had done, I realized that Earl Warren was in many respects singularly responsible for the detention of the Japanese in World War II. I read the comments that he made, his public positions, and I realized that it was both racist and cynically opportunistic. I use the term racist in the sense that he said things that I don't think, we don't even have to look at it in terms of the time. I mean, they were racist at the time and they are racist now. And I was shocked at that. And I was shocked at the other names that I saw that were involved in this, William O. Douglas, people like that. The things that kind of American iconic figures did, which really to me were tarnished their legacy. I mean, it was hard for me to look at that and say, well, why didn't Earl Warren ever admit that what he did was just wrong? And the answer is he never did. And he didn't want to talk about it. He made one comment at one time, which implied that maybe he regretted some of it. But what he did was lead the way in probably one of the worst civil rights violations for American citizens that we have in our history. And that was shocking to me. I'm not naive, but that was shocking to me when I read it. And I did a lot of research about that. And there were people like, for example, J. Edgar Hoover, who has become somewhat of a reviled figure in American history. But J. Edgar Hoover, as the head of the FBI, was absolutely opposed to this and was very vocal with President Roosevelt that this was not the right thing to do. The Attorney General, a man by the name of Francis Biddle, was extremely opposed to this. So I was fascinated by, how did we get ourselves into this mess? And did anybody start to think about it once it started to evolve? So those are things that I looked at. But again, I wanted to write a story about people. I mean, some people look at this and they say, well, this is a book about war. It isn't a book about war. War is the backdrop for a story about people. This is really about people. And a lot of the characters in this book, when you read about them, they aren't in the war. They are suffering the consequences of it, but they aren't in the war.
With respect to 9066 and the impact that it had, and 120,000 Japanese Americans on the West Coast being forced off the land where many of them had been born, where they'd been making their living. I think a lot of people, especially those of us who weren't alive, we hear about it. And even some of the veterans I talk to, as they recall it, it has this tone of, well, it was an overreaction to what happened at Pearl Harbor. And this was purely a reactionary thing born out of the emotion of the moment. And it sounds like to me that in your research, you found out that wasn't necessarily the case, that there was some forethought given to this kind of exercise.
Yes. One of the things that I was able to do is research at Stanford the papers of a man by the name of Carl Benditson. And Carl Benditson was a Stanford law graduate. He was in the military, and he was really the individual who was the architect of this. You know, he was directed to do it, and he put it together logistically. But it was clear from his papers, and he kept everything, that this whole thing had been planned long in advance of Pearl Harbor. They were looking at not just the Japanese, but German nationals, Italian nationals, people that were living in this country that were not citizens, and they were contemplating how to deal with this whole thing, how to deal with Hawaii before Pearl Harbor happened. They had already plotted out all of the fairgrounds, for example, that could be used as relocation centers. So all of that had been done in advance. This was not something that somebody after Pearl Harbor said, oh, let's go use the fairgrounds. They had already decided all of this. They had a roadmap in place. And I found that out and was also able to do independent research for some other universities on the East Coast that were interested in answers to questions. And I found out how the military knew about all of that.
And as a follow-up question, and we know what happened to the Japanese Americans, and we've heard isolated instances of the way some Italian Americans and German Americans were treated, even to the degree of if they ended up in the military where they were sent. But have you been able to decipher that, why there wasn't a large-scale detention of those ethnicities the way there were with the Japanese Americans?
Yes, it became very clear in Benditson's papers and also my other research that they quickly realized at the highest levels of government that the Army had a lot of people of German descent, people of Italian descent. But the one comment that stood out to me more than anything else was the comment that they couldn't imprison the people that were Italian that were not yet citizens because Joe DiMaggio's father would have been imprisoned. And here is this, you know, this American baseball legend. And that really was one of the things that turned it. And it also isolated the Japanese Americans because they were easy to distinguish from Caucasians. There was a lot of prejudice, of course. Roosevelt, you know, he had his own views of Asians. You know, it was a different time. I mean, I'm not here to talk about, you know, being critical of the morality of people at that time, but they were able to single these people out. We had to have scapegoats. They bombed Pearl Harbor. They're a scapegoat. That's kind of what allowed them to be separated and segregated.
It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with author James Ardaiz. Learn more about his book, Tears of Honor, at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking this year's Day of Remembrance and the 79th anniversary of Executive Order 9066 by learning about a new book that captures what life was like before, during, and after the internment of 120,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry. Tears of Honor uses a mix of real historic figures and some fictional names that combine the true stories of multiple Japanese Americans. One of the names that hasn't been changed is that of a Korean American who was assigned to an all-Japanese American unit and became one of America's most decorated soldiers. We're going to hear about that soon from James Ardise, the author of the book. But to set a little context, let's hear a brief clip from one of the many Nisei veterans we've had the privilege of hearing from on Hometown Heroes. This is Sherman Kishi describing some of his memories as a teenager forced off the land where he'd been born in Livingston, California.
Very shortly after going into the camp, we had some very well-educated people who had gone to college, unable to get jobs because jobs weren't available to people of Japanese descent. And so they were well-educated, and they immediately started things within the camp. And one of the things that started was baseball. And baseball became a very popular pastime in Merced Assembly Center as it was in the later relocation camps. So there were things like talent shows. I remember very vividly one talent show that we went to that had a young lady from Walnut Grove who had a beautiful contralto voice, and one of the most popular songs that was sung at the time was God Bless America. Can you imagine? Yeah, that's what happened during those days, yeah.
And the irony, huh? God bless America when you're basically being held prisoner by America.
That's exactly right.
You can link to that complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com, but that brief anecdote from Sherman Kishi parallels the dichotomy James Ardise explores in his new book, Tears of Honor.
Well, the one question that I decided I wanted to answer in this book was, why did these young men go and do what they did? And why did their parents support that? The answer came back fairly quickly, but I didn't want it to be cliche. I mean, the real answer to that was because we're Americans and we were fighting for our country too, even though our country did something that was wrong, and they were able to separate that. So you even saw the folks at home in these detention centers waiting for telegrams about their sons, just like everybody else, and getting those, you know, Western Union telegrams saying that their son had been killed in action. And you saw mothers worrying. You saw sons fighting. The evolution of the 100th 442nd in not just becoming an all-Japanese combat unit, but being a go-to unit that when you needed something difficult to be done, they were the ones that were called upon. You know, there are people that think that the Japanese-American units were hurled into hopeless situations because they were expendable. I never found that. What I found was, the unfortunate thing is that when you're the toughest unit around, you're going to be called for the toughest situations. And I really think that that played more of a role than, you know, throwing men into difficult situations. When you see what happened at Monte Cassino, for example, which was horrific, and talking to men that were there, I found that they were there fighting alongside other units, but they were there because they needed somebody to punch through, and by God, these guys they did it. I mean, they did it, and I'm not sure now when I look at what we have there that, honestly, that generationally we have the same stuff. I'd like to think we do, but when I talk to these men and I read about what they did and tried to write about it and make it live for readers today, you can't look at that without thinking, I'm making this stuff up. And the answer is no. This is very carefully documented. And I use fictional characters to illustrate it, but I used the real commanders and everything else, what they did, what they said, you know, that's what happened. So what's in this book is what it happened to somebody, or it really happened to the individual that is named in this book. I tried to be very accurate about that.
You put it as a perception that they had been expendable. I think one of the reasons that perception has persisted over the years is the rescue of the Lost Battalion. A little more than 200 mostly white soldiers, the Texas Battalion, that are rescued by the 442nd, who suffers 800 casualties in doing so. So the ratio there, I think, is what makes people think, hey, they were expendable. Are you saying it was more about their tenacity and the go-for-broke mentality?
I think that's true. I think that the general that was in charge, from a military standpoint, it was a pragmatic military decision. I mean, in other words, I think he needed men that were going to go into a very difficult situation. He knew men were going to be lost to rescue this group. You have the fact that the Alamo Regiment, the Lost Texas Battalion, was basically white. You know, at that time, when they put these regiments together, they did it from geographic regions, so not like nowadays. So that's how you ended up with the Texas Battalion, the Alamo Regiment. So sending in the 100th, I don't think that the decision to send them in had to do with the fact that they were expendable. I think it had to do with the fact that they were the toughest unit around, and they knew that they would do what needed to be done. And then, of course, people look at it and say, well, gee whiz, the people they rescued were all white. And that's true, but I don't think you would hear men that were there at Bifontaine and rescued the Lost Texas Battalion saying that they thought they were there because they were not white. I certainly think the men that were rescued, and I got the opportunity to talk to them, at least two of them, I don't think that entered into it at all, other than, you know, these units were not well known. The story of the Lost Texas Battalion is such a fantastic story in and of itself. But when they were rescued, they see these, what they described as little brown men running from tree to tree, and they realize they're Japanese, but the Japanese are part of the Axis powers, and they're trying to figure out how the Japanese got, you know, why are they here? So they didn't really know about these units. These units were not that well publicized.
And there's a character that emerges in your book that is not a fictional character, that's a real-life character who you got to spend a lot of time with, Young Oak Kim. What is it about his profile, the arc of his actions in World War II and beyond, that really captivated you and made him such a central figure here?
When I was researching, the same name kept coming up in different actions. Young Oak Kim, a Korean. And I thought, well, how did a Korean end up in a Japanese unit? As I read about him, when he graduated at Fort Benning as a lieutenant, at that time, everybody got their orders, and he didn't get any orders because nobody wanted him because he was Asian. And he graduated at the top of his class. And ultimately, he was sent to the 100th, and he didn't even know about the Japanese-American unit. He didn't know where he was going. And he went to the 100th, and when he showed up, the first comment that the white officers made, because most of the ranking officers in the 100th, which was the unit that came out of Hawaii, were white. They said, you're Korean. Japanese don't like Koreans. Koreans don't like Japanese. And so you can leave. And he said, no, I'm not going to leave. And the commander said to him in a well-documented conversation, well, you're going to have to get used to them. And he said, well, they're going to have to get used to me. And it just struck me. And I thought, and I started reading about this man. He just seemed like such an unusual character. And the more I read about him, the more I realized that we were talking about a man who was really a great American hero. I mean, he was a highly decorated. He was one of the most decorated men to come out of World War II. And I've often said he was kind of like the Asian Audie Murphy. I mean, I was stunned. I decided to use him as an arcing character because he went through so many of the battles. So I was fortunate to be able to spend 6 months interviewing him. He fought in World War II, in Korea, and in Vietnam, and was just an absolutely heroic figure. I mean, I use that term, but that's when you read about what he did, which is so well documented, and you talk to him, he's just kind of an awe-inspiring figure. I interviewed him at the Go for Broke Foundation in Los Angeles. Go for Broke is the motto of the 100th 442nd, so they have a foundation, and a lot of these old veterans gather there. It's not really a clubhouse, but it does have an area like that. And I watched Colonel Kim walk in, and he walked in on a walker, and here were all these old guys, all of them who had been scarred by real battle. And it was like watching Moses walk across the Red Sea. I'd never seen anything like it. I mean, everybody stood up when he walked into the room, and they just spread. And I realized that among what we would call heroes, and I think we use that term a little too generously nowadays, but among what were real heroes, he was the guy that they parted for. So I knew that he was something special. And I got to spend a tremendous amount of time talking to him. He had lived through the worst times of World War II. He was the intelligence officer that was, in my view, personally responsible for gaining the intelligence to move the 5th Army off the beachhead at Anzio whenever they were basically trapped there. And when you read about what he did, it was like, I mean, when he told me what he did, and I already knew what he did, I mean, I wanted to say, are you nuts? I mean, it was just, you know, you think, people think you're making it up.
And could you give us an example of that? I mean, I want people to read the book, Tears of Honor, and learn about Young Ok Kim and some of the other exemplary characters here. But is there like a particular action or mindset or courage that he displayed in a situation that was really one of those things that grabbed you that said, boy, how can I be sitting here talking to this guy right now?
Well, I'll use the example at Anzio. The American Army, 5th Army, Mark Clark's army, was trapped. They needed intelligence. They knew that the Germans had panzer units and their Tiger tanks were coming in, and they had far more firepower than American tanks did. So the American Army was very much afraid of the panzer units, the Tiger units. They needed to know where the Germans were going to be. So the American Army was kind of at the beachhead. The Germans were on the other side, and it was kind of this weird no man's land thing where they would kind of come out and see each other and maybe wave a little bit and then bomb the hell out of each other during the day and at night. So Kim volunteered to cross this no man's land, which was a large area of grass between the two armies, a ditch, and then the Germans were dug in and they had cement machine gun nests and that type of thing on the other side, and get prisoners. They needed prisoners. Well, it would be like crawling across a football field with grass about a foot and a half high. So Kim took another man, and when he volunteered, he was told no, that it was a suicide mission. He said, well, you need to take it up the chain of command. And so they did. And it finally, every commander refused except Mark Clark, who said, we've got to do it. And if he's willing to do it, okay. So he crawled across at night, and he always carried a machine gun, and he never wore a helmet. He only wore a knit beanie. He crawled across and waited until early morning hours, and then there was an open area covered by machine guns, and he crawled across the open area right next to a German pillbox. He could hear the Germans inside the pillbox, and he got over to a slit trench where a couple of German non-commissioned officers were sleeping. He stuck his Tommy gun in the mouth of one of the sleeping Germans so that when the man opened his eyes, he saw this Korean sitting there with a machine gun, a Tommy gun in his mouth. And the other man that he went across with, the man by the name of Irving Iwanoki, they then took those men in the sight of German machine guns, made them crawl back across this open road into the field, kept those prisoners until it was dark and all day long, and then crawled all the way back, getting the intelligence information that they needed to push through. Now, in me telling that, sounds like, well, yeah, you know, but he crawled several hundred yards. It would be like crawling 400 yards or 500 yards on your belly, and then in full sight of gun towers, crawling across, bringing prisoners back, keeping everybody quiet, and accomplishing what he did. Mark Clark gave him the Distinguished Service Cross when he came out on the spot, which is the highest award that a field commander can provide, other than the Medal of Honor, which, you know, has to be done separately. And it was just, you know, I mean, everybody regarded it as a suicide mission. When you read about what he did, you think he should have been dead every step of the way, and yet he never hesitated. Now, when he told me that story, he told it to me just about exactly the way I just told it to you. And it was like, with me sitting there thinking, what kind of a man am I talking to? He won the French Legion of Honor for separate engagements in France, the highest award that they could give. And when he was recalled to duty in Korea, he won the Korean Medal of Honor for a separate engagement. And then he won everything in between. But I mean, it's like saying, yeah, and then he got a couple of silver stars and he got a couple of, you know, I mean, it was awe-inspiring to talk to him. But I think I've indicated there was no embellishment. There was no brag. There was nothing. It was just like a man saying, yeah, I went to work today and, you know, this is what I did. And he came back and he was just an amazing man. And he was regarded by the people around him as an amazing man. And when I was privileged to be invited to his funeral, and when I say to be invited, it was pretty much a closed type of thing. But there were these huge flower arrangements from the United States Army, from France, and from Korea. And there were field grade officers there from those countries. And then there were all these old men that had been part of the 100th, 442nd. And his remains were in an urn. And there was a picture of him in his full dress uniform as a colonel. They just kind of formed a line. And you'd see these colonels and generals walk up and salute And then all these old men just walk up individually and salute. So you realize that it was a privilege to know somebody like this. This was a real American hero.
And you can learn about him in the new book, Tears of Honor. If you live near the author, James Ardaiz, in Central California, you can pick up that book at a book barn in Clovis. But wherever you're listening right now, you can order it online. I have a link up for you at hometownheroesradio.com and on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll have more about the book, more about Young Oak Kim, and more about the underlying theme of this labor of love that is something that couldn't be more timely or relevant. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking the annual Day of Remembrance, a day when, regardless of what we look like or what our last name may be, we can join Americans of Japanese ancestry in remembering what happened 79 years ago when Executive Order 9066 led to 120,000 people being uprooted from their homes and held behind barbed wire. 33,000 Japanese Americans would serve in our armed forces in World War II once the government stopped considering them enemy aliens. Some of them served in the military intelligence service throughout the Pacific, others in the 100th Infantry Battalion and 442nd Regimental Combat Team, becoming the most decorated unit in American military history. In researching his book, Tears of Honor, author James Ardaiz spoke with Al Tortolano, one of the 211 men rescued in what has become the most well-known achievement of that Go for Broke unit. You can link to Al's original Hometown Heroes interview online, but here's what he told us about that moment of liberation.
When we found out that they finally broke through, oh man, it was like the sun coming out after a storm, you know. You figure it was 7 days of what we went through. It was really hell up there. When all of a sudden we heard one guy say, oh my God, we're fighting the Japs. Because we didn't even know at the time that there was a 442nd, mm-hmm. and yet they were attached to our division at times. Mm-hmm. But we didn't even know, and that's why that's one guy that made that remark when we saw Japanese soldiers who were fighting the Japs. But then we found out they're our rescuers, and all we wanted to do was get out of there. I know when they first rescued us, I was so happy and thankful for it. And then when we found out we didn't know until way later how many they actually lost. And I thought about it. I felt so bad because I said, here's a group of people that were used during the war. I don't know how to put it, but it seemed like when any dirty job had to be done or any fighting that they feel was almost impossible, the 442nd was always involved. Then I find out what their parents went through. And for them to volunteer to fight for their country like they did, I didn't know how to think about it. I just grabbed them and want to hug them.
Years later, Al Tortolano would get to hug one of his liberators. While driving a patient shuttle at a VA facility in Palo Alto, California, he met Lawson Sakai, who had been wounded and nearly killed in that effort to free the Lost Battalion. You can find Lawson's complete interview online, too. But for today's program, these words from Lawson Sakai seem to really dovetail with James Ardise's book, Tears of Honor.
I think we did what we intended to do. I'm sorry that, like my parents and all the other Issei who are now all gone, didn't really live long enough to capitalize on what we had gotten for them. 1952, I believe, they were allowed to become naturalized citizens of the United States. You know, a huge turnaround from deportation to naturalization, you know, and all because of what their children, the Nisei boys, did for them. Mm-hmm. And I think that is very important to impress on, like, my children and their children, that they know that that first generation that was born here suffered along with their parents because they couldn't get jobs either. But by doing what they did, going to war and so forth, they created the life for them that's so good.
That was the voice of Lawson Sakai, helping us understand why it is so important to remember. If you're a regular listener to this program, you've heard Lawson Sakai, you've heard Al Tortolano, but until today, you might not have heard that name, Young Oak Kim. If you read James Ardise's new book, Tears of Honor, as you follow two aspiring Japanese-American ballplayers named Sammy and Freddie and their journey through the internment, the war, and beyond, you're also going to learn, and I know I'm thankful to have learned more, about this Korean-American hero who served along with those gopher broke men of the 100th and 442nd.
In World War II, as in any war, you have a lot of people who do heroic things that really aren't recognized or achieve a certain commonality in the sense of that's just what people do. And the answer is it's not what people do, number one. But you have some individuals who just simply stand out among other men and women. That's him. You know, I think the American people should see this. They'll also see the actions of the Japanese Americans and what they did, particularly in the rescue of the Lost Texas Battalion, which is told here. I mean, one thing I want to emphasize is you and I are talking about war, but this isn't a book about war. This is a book about people, and war is a backdrop because it brings out the best and the worst, I think, in people. But it's a book about people who are reacting to war that they're placed in, whether it's mom and dad, whether it's your son, whether it's your fiance, whatever it may be. So there's a lot of, this is a human interest story against the backdrop of war. So I don't like it when people say, well, you wrote a book about war. My answer is no, I wrote a book about people. I go to the fairgrounds now and I look around the fairgrounds and I see what people lived in, and they're still there. And I think, when I was a kid, I used to walk through here and all I saw was horses. I didn't see that people actually lived in these stables. So, you know, I wanted to say, well, okay, so when they put them in these places, life goes on. How do you deal with that? You know, somebody dies, what do? Somebody has a baby, what do? And then I wanted to use baseball as the kind of the metaphor, because it's such a traditionally American game. Baseball is something that you see as a recurrent theme in this book. You know, whether it's before the war as people are playing baseball and who their heroes are, in the internment camps, whenever they form baseball teams. And I used the names of people here in the valley that were big baseball players of Japanese American descent. So those names are in there. To a certain extent, they're placed in fictionalized situations, but they're in there as baseball figures, and it's kind of an homage to what they did. People don't know about those people, but they'll recognize some of the names and they'll realize, oh, you know, I thought he was a chiropractor.
That kind of thing. That jumped out at me when I saw Zenimura Nakagawa pop up in there and some others. As an aside, with Young Oak Kim, you could say on one hand, what difference does it make? And I think of Joe Sakato, or some people knew him as George, who was a Japanese-American Medal of Honor winner, who in the war was given the Distinguished Service Cross, wounded in freeing the Lost Battalion. Never got to see the completion of that. But, you know, years later, when Clinton's president, he's part of a large group of minority medal honorees whose medals were upgraded to the Medal of Honor. He didn't even know it was going on, so he certainly wasn't seeking it. But for you, in seeing some of the recognition and the decoration of Japanese Americans of the actions you just described with Young Ok Kim at Anzio, is that something you think, in your opinion, should have been upgraded to the Medal of Honor?
Well, I do, and I don't want to compare it to other men who won the Medal of Honor. That's such a singular medal in terms of what it means. But I would say that certainly when you look at what he did, I would say that he is as deserving as what other men did. I mean, frequently when people win the Medal of Honor, they win it posthumously.
Yeah.
So Kim, when you look at what he did at that time, they weren't giving out Medals of Honor to Asians. I mean, you have to consider that this man went on a mission that every single commander regarded as a suicide mission, and he volunteered to do it knowing that. The theater commander approved it because they desperately needed the information and believed that it was a suicide mission, did not think that Kim would survive. And then when you look at what he did, it's like, okay, what defines a hero? The interesting thing I found with Kim is I doubt if he gave a moment's thought to that.
Exactly.
I really don't.
Which underscores the heroism in my mind. And I wonder if maybe that's the reason that it would be a good thing if he were given the Medal of Honor now. Yeah, he's gone. What difference does it make? Well, maybe the difference it makes is more people know his story if his medal were upgraded to the Medal of Honor.
Well, I agree. And I think also everybody needs their heroes. The Korean community, for example, there's a large Korean community in Los Angeles. But I think recognizing when you, it's something that we have in our society. One of the things that we look at and we say, well, gee, you know, I need to see my face up there on the court. I need to see my face in government. Well, we know, for example, that in World War II and certainly in World War I, we didn't have integrated units. And so we had separate African-American units. And yet those units, particularly later in the war when they were allowed to actually participate in combat, did amazing things. That needs to be recognized. It's kind of like our Buffalo soldiers that we had. You know, that needs to be recognized because that helps elevate community and our culture. So, yeah, I don't think Young Ok Kim deserves a Medal of Honor because he's Korean. I think Young Ok Kim deserves a Medal of Honor because he deserves a Medal of Honor. But I think it would mean a lot to the community. And I think it's something that, you know, it's overdue. There are a lot of men and women that have done things that probably are maybe, if not equivalent, certainly of singular acts of courage, which will never be recognized. We'll never know about them. So I think when we have a real hero and we know, then we should recognize that and celebrate it, and kids should know.
Well, maybe this book, Tears of Honor, will help accomplish that. If there's anything else you want to share about the book and what you've learned putting it together, feel free. I think the last question I have is from a big picture perspective. When someone's done flipping through all these pages, and I'm sure you felt like you could have written five of these books with all the knowledge that you gleaned in these years, but is there one reality that you want people to take away from this book, a message or an understanding that maybe even you discovered along the way?
I have a lot of questions that I'm asked sometimes and was asked by publishers and agents about the title. And a lot of people didn't like the title. Some people, you know, love the title. I like the title. So that was it. Why is that the title? Well, you'll know that the answer to that when you get to the end of the book. And I want people to read this and know that as much as we may look different, one step below that visual appearance, there's really very little difference among us. We want the same things. We hope for the same things. We cry over the same things. Once we recognize that, we will realize that, you know, the things that make us a little different are to be celebrated, our heritage. But the thing that makes us the same, that's the thing that makes us Americans. And I would like people to finish this book, put it down, think about what's in it, and realize we're far more alike than we are different, and we need to all stick together because the things that make us the same are what's really important. That's what I want people to realize, and I hope that people get out of this book.
You write in your introduction that both of your parents served in World War II. And, you know, as I spend all this time talking to World War II vets and I'll interact with kids and people today, they may think they're not connected to World War II. But I always find in some way we all are. And clearly, if both of your parents served, you are. Can you share anything about what your parents did or how that impacted you?
My father was in the Aleutians in World War II. He was an infantry officer in the Aleutians, and he was actually on a, I'll call it a tugboat. It wasn't exactly a tugboat, but the Army used that up there. So he was up there when the Japanese tried to attack the Aleutians and basically foundered. My mother was a frontline field nurse in the South Pacific in World War II. And I always laughed because I think my father resented the fact that my mother saw more combat than my dad did. But she was literally on the front line. She was in a frontline unit as boys came off the line. My mother, her closest friend, she had a couple of women that she palled around with her, you know, later in life. One of whom was Japanese-American and who had been interned. And of course, in the South Pacific, the combat was against Japanese. My mother had no prejudices that I could ever glean against anybody. But when she was 70, we took her to Pearl Harbor, and I watched her and her anger over all of the Japanese tourists going out there and how upset she got. I mean, I had to actually go over and kind of restrain her and pull her away because I heard this old woman telling people they shouldn't be allowed to be there. She told me later when she was standing there at the Arizona Memorial, she said, and she was crying, and I seldom saw my mother crying, and she said, "You just don't understand." And I, you know, she was right. I didn't. But, you know, for my parents, it was a defining event in their lives. I mean, everything seemed to stem from that. You know, we talk about that generation, but I think that the war was a defining moment. And I don't think we have ever, and my generation has ever had a defining moment like that, where we all came together. I mean, Vietnam was about as divisive as it could be, and Korea was about as ambiguous as it could be. Nobody knows what the hell Iraq and Afghanistan are. So for them, yeah, I dedicated this book in part to them because this is really a book about their generation. So I hope this book tells people about what our obligations are when times get tough, but also helps them celebrate the fact that they're Americans. It certainly made me feel that way. I would encourage people to look at this as a story about people and not about war. At the end of the book, I hope that what they care about are less the story and more the people. And they think about that for a long time.
Again, the book is Tears of Honor by James Ardise. I have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com as well as that Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. But we're out of time today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.